Welcome to Fresh Research, a podcast from the nonprofit Times. We explore some of the most interesting and sometimes provocative findings focused on the world of nonprofits. Thanks for tuning in. Here at the nonprofit Times, we see tons of great fresh research. So in each episode, we take a recent study or survey and have a conversation with the authors about what they found and why they think it's important for charities. We'll also give away some books and give you access to other valuable information from the nonprofit Times.
In early 2020, you couldn't blame nonprofit executives for thinking that the sky may have been falling. At the outbreak of the coronavirus pandemic, events were canceled or shifted online, facilities were shut down if not severely limited, while food banks and other service charities were overwhelmed with need. Where would the money come from to keep the doors open and the programs afloat? It turned out that, as usual, Americans came through with donations. In some cases, it wasn't just once or twice either, but multiple times over the course of the year. Revenue for the largest nonprofits in the U.S. was up almost 3% last year, including a 6% spike in public support. Those estimates come from the 2021 NPT 100, the 34th annual study of the largest nonprofits in the nation that derive at least 10% of their revenue from public support. Hi, I'm Mark Harivna for the Nonprofit Times. In this episode, I talk with Jacob Harold, Executive Vice President of Candid, about the trends and nuances within the latest NPT 100. Candid provides some of the data for the NPT 100. Grant Thornton also helps to compile and analyze the numbers. And this year, Data Axel helped design the charts you see in the report, which can be found in the November edition. And now, here's my conversation with Jacob Harold. Jacob, thanks so much for your time. Thanks especially to Candid for helping us out with some of the data collection on this year's NPT 100. It's always a big help. You've had some time to look at the data and the numbers. What were your first impressions of this year's NPT 100 as far as revenue, expenses, or any of the above?
Sure. Well, it's great to be here, Mark, and we're so glad to work with you all on this. And, you know, when I got the spreadsheet from you, you know, I was very curious to see what the numbers would show us, since it mixes your data that you get directly from these organizations with some of ours in a new way. And, you know, to me, the big takeaway is that it's relatively good news for the sector. I mean, we're still in the middle of the biggest pandemic this country has seen in a century, all sorts of economic dislocation. And the NPT 100 shows that overall, the largest nonprofits have done okay. And, you know, we'll talk over this conversation on how that wasn't true for all of them. But, you know, the first thing I did when I saw this data is I went and I added up the column for revenue for all 100, and I added up the column for expenses for all 100. And we look at them all together, you see that in aggregate, the NPT 100 turned a profit in 2020. You know, obviously not profit in the business sense, but that there was more money coming in than going out. And we should talk about, you know, the ways that that's both a good and a bad thing, that obscures a lot of dynamics with individual organizations and, of course, smaller ones that aren't a part of this list. But it was quite striking for me to see that. And I think that is worth us in the sector reflecting on, you know, how is it that during a crisis like this, the sector as a whole, or at least this group as a whole, was able to come away not having to dip into reserves, ultimately actually strengthening balance sheets. And I think that's a question that has a number of different dimensions to it that we should explore, but is the biggest single takeaway for me.
It was often described in the early days of the pandemic as a slow-moving disaster. And a lot of the organizations I talked to did kind of describe it as a disaster in that there were almost disaster donors where they were giving because the need was so great. You know, you remember the huge lines at food banks around the country, and food banks were extremely prominent on this list this year. You know, your usual Feeding America billion-dollar organization, but you also had other food banks that really shot up the list, and other food banks that made the list for the first time. And they talked about, like, for instance, Houston Food Bank returned for the first time in two or three years, and they were actually on the list the last time was Hurricane Harvey back in about 2017. When I talked to them, they said what struck them was that these weren't typical disaster donors in that they gave and the disaster was over. The hurricane was now cleaning up. This time they actually gave throughout the year, multiple times, which really surprised them. And a lot of these organizations talked about how many new donors they had. I mean, some of the numbers are just astounding. I think part of the formula now is what will nonprofits do to retain those donors, whether they're new or returning.
I think that's all right. And you know, the examples you're citing really they remind us that this data reflects the reality on the ground. You know, thinking about hunger organizations and thinking about the images that we saw of food distribution in stadium parking lots a year ago, and just how terrifyingly long some of those lines were. And also that sometimes there were some pretty nice cars in those lines. And that this crisis hit a cross-section of society in some complex ways. And I think that a lot of donors recognize that and they change their patterns. I think you see this at both the individual level, as you just cited, donors who became ongoing supporters of a given nonprofit and not just popping in at the moment of, you know, a particular disaster, but becoming part of a community. And then you also saw this with institutional donors that in some cases gave more, and in many cases also gave in a different way. They relaxed restrictions. They made the process easier. You know, the prototypical example of this is the giving by Mackenzie Scott and Dan Jewett. And it's a reminder that people are actually paying attention to what's happening on the ground, and that that ends up reflected in the data. Now, there's a good side and a bad side to this. There's a good side when that generosity comes in and fills a gap that has been left by this crisis. But you also see on some of those organizations that had a harder time, that it tends to reflect their actual operational business model. To me, the most obvious example is the Y there at number one, but with revenue down $1.7 billion from the previous year. And that is, you know, predominantly a reflection of the fact that there's a lot of revenue they couldn't get because people couldn't come into their facilities. And, you know, it's an interesting contrast to an organization like, say, the United Way that saw an increase in total revenue of $1.1 billion, partly because of the gifts from Mackenzie Scott and Dan Jewett, but also because of broader increased generosity on the part of communities that were looking to distribute to a variety of different needs that people were experiencing, and recognize that an institution like United Way as an intermediary could help to facilitate that. So the United Way, in a sense, that abstraction of the United Way actually worked to its advantage during the pandemic, whereas the concrete nature of the Y worked to its disadvantage. And while I do think it's really important for us to talk about the sector as a whole, and that's why I started with this. And in fact, I should note that Canda just released a new tool that we call the US Social Sector Dashboard. You can get to it from the main page of our website, that looks at the entire sector and tries to imagine it as a community or even an ecosystem. And that it's really important to zoom out and think at that level, but also to remember that beneath that aggregate, there are all these individual stories and they play out in very different ways in different communities. And that is very obvious in this list of large organizations, the contrast that you see between, say, the Y and United Way, or, you know, organizations that really were hit hard, whether Catholic Charities down $283 million, or Planned Parenthood down $277 million, or major arts institutions, the MoMA down $181 million, the Met down $100 million. Some organizations really were hit hard. And I think that variety of stories that we see in this top 100 list shows up among medium and smaller nonprofits as well. And it will take years for us to suss out all of those stories. But it is a reminder that it's really a mixed picture. And it's a mixed picture that arguably reflects inequality, in that these larger organizations overall did well. We have a strong hypothesis that the smaller and medium-sized organizations didn't necessarily have the resources to be resilient in the same way, although they were resilient in their own ways, and that the variety of ways that citizens experience the pandemic is reflected in a variety of ways that institutions experienced the pandemic.
Yeah, I often remember to remind myself that this is a snapshot of 1 year and just basically year over year growth or decline rather than say multi-year. So I think that's important to also note as far as just the trends of increased donors and say, for instance, like you mentioned, arts organizations, you know, they were down this year, just like sort of just how they were down after the recession when donors concentrated on you know, basic services, just like they did now. And interesting too, the note, when you bring up United Way, when you look below the numbers, they had a $1 billion increase, but the vast majority of that was from Mackenzie Scott and Dan Jewett's gifts, about $650 million, and then another $220 million directly from COVID relief funds. So if you take that out of the equation, the numbers for United Way don't really look all that encouraging in terms of growth, which I think is something to really to take note of, much in the way that say Giving USA individual giving numbers were impacted by the Mackenzie Scott gifts because they were just so enormous and such an aberration.
Yeah, I mean, it was a year of aberrations upon aberrations. You know, the context was so different. The needs were so different. And then you have, you know, billions of dollars dropping out of the sky, you know, from, you know, this new mega donor. And so, you know, on the one hand, it makes it hard for us to talk about 2020 in terms of trends because of these multi-layered sort of unique dynamics. And we really have to zoom out more to think about trends, you know, and that's where, you know, when we've looked at aggregate revenue and aggregate expenses in the social sector over the last 20 years, there is a pretty steady growth trajectory. And, you know, one thing we talked about last year was that when we look back 20 years, we see that every single year in aggregate, the social sector has, again, quote unquote, turned a profit. Revenue has been higher than expenses. And that is great news for the social sector as a whole. And it reflects, I think, financial responsibility and the growth of institutions that are important for communities. But it's also really striking that you think organizations are bringing in this money in order to strengthen their balance sheets. And that what you will often hear from boards of directors is they're doing this to be ready for a rainy day. And yet, if you look at the last couple of recessions, even during those recessions, nonprofits were able to sock away a little extra money in aggregate. If we look at these numbers of the top 100, it would suggest that that may be true even during a pandemic. Now, we haven't looked at that in aggregate. And I made a prediction last year that I thought maybe 2020 would be the first year in two decades when the nonprofit sector as a whole finally dipped into its collective reserves. We'll have to see how that plays out. But, you know, to me, this is encouraging because it does show the aggregate financial strength of the social sector. But it also, to me, raises the question of, you know, if not now, when? You know, if not during a pandemic, when should the social sector dig deep into its reserves? And, you know, maybe was there a missed opportunity to for nonprofits to make more sacrifices financially in order to serve communities better? And, you know, I don't have an answer for that question, but I think it's a question we need to ask and, you know, think about, does this aggregate success demand even more from the social sector and raise questions about how we use these resources for the greater good?
Yeah, that reminds me of a couple different stories from some of the charities I spoke with regarding reserves and planning for the future. If you talk to some of these organizations a year ago, they probably would have said, you know, yeah, we're planning to use reserves because, you know, we've been decimated. The program service revenue is not there because of canceled events or other you know, other things. Like, for instance, YMCA had a big drop in program because people weren't able to literally go to their buildings. for whatever they were normally would go, whether it's the gym or different programming. And for instance, Leukemia Lymphoma Society, who I spoke with, they had been planning to use reserve, but didn't end up using it because their fundraising from some of their events was even better than they expected. They were fortunate in that. It was only the last quarter of the previous fiscal year that was impacted by COVID with canceled events. So just as COVID was starting, that was the last quarter of their fiscal year. But then they also realized going into the next year with virtual events, they realized just as much fundraising as previously, just without all the expenses of having an actual physical event. And so going forward, they'll probably have some mix of hybrid to cut back on those expenses of events. And they also took the opportunity to consolidate and reorganize their entire organization from, I think it was 56 affiliates into 27 regions. So, you know, COVID kind of seemed to implement or was the impetus to implement some wide-ranging changes at that organization. And I'm sure that's the case throughout the nonprofit sector.
I'm so encouraged to hear that. I didn't know, you know, some of those nuances about the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. Did you hear that from others? In particular, I'm interested around this question of restructuring, that, you know, they reorganized their network. Did you hear that from any others?
Offhand, nothing comes to mind in terms of restructuring necessarily, but obviously the way that they're the way that they're going forward, I think a couple organizations, because this past year was so huge for them, that they, you know, it may be a watershed year in terms of this is where they go from, you know, a small nonprofit to a mega nonprofit. Two organizations that just absolutely jumped out this year were GiveDirectly, and they ranked number 70 with $306 million. And that's up from $45 million the previous year. And they also got $70 million from Mackenzie Scott and Dan Jewett. But even if you take out the $70 million, they still would have made the list, and they still would have been quadrupled almost their revenue from the previous year. So this is the kind of year where maybe they take a huge jump over the next few years in terms of restructuring or just expanding to that extent. And the other one was the CDC Foundation, which of course had all kinds of fundraising initiatives in response to the pandemic. And they weren't a small organization by any means before. The previous year they had $80 million in revenue, but it was sort of a niche organization. They obviously got a good bit of government support, but they raised money typically through their employees, retirees. And with all the fundraising they did, they jumped up to $255 million. That ranked 86th. But what just absolutely blew me away was that typically they would have about 7,000 donors a year. And that last year, they jumped that up to 110,000 donors. So they have all kinds of new potential resources going forward that could dramatically change the face of that entire organization. And they've already started to some extent in terms of adding major gifts officers, boosting their planned giving program, you know, things that may not pay off right away. But I think there's some of these organizations are going to point back to this year in terms of just being transformative for the long term.
Those are such interesting examples. And I would argue that both of them fit into broader cultural dynamics and in pretty different ways. You know, GiveDirectly, you know, is based on the idea that poor people are poor because they don't have enough money. And the best thing to do is just give them money. And that is a simple theory of change. And there's increasing evidence that it actually can be very powerful in the long term.
You know, that reminds me of, I had to jump in there with a quote. GiveDirectly is a fascinating concept. Like you mentioned, I was interviewing the CEO of Direct Relief out of Santa Barbara, who also had a big year, Tom Teague. And during our conversation, he said, money is a helpful resource, particularly for those who don't have much of it. And I think that just ties in completely. It seems so obvious, which of course it is, but there's this concept of, you know, having to do something for it or just not giving direct cash to people. I just wanted to jump in and use that quote because I thought it worked, but please continue.
You know, and I saw that quote in your article, and I was struck by it as well. And that, you know, there is an argument that sometimes we in the sector overcomplicate our theories of change, right. And that there are simpler ways to do good. And this, in interesting ways, connects to the government stimulus package and to, I think, a broader understanding of, you know, the importance of consumer spending in an economy. And interestingly, this also ties to the cultural influence of Silicon Valley and the way that Silicon Valley donors think. And you see this with GiveDirectly, given how much they've relied on donations of cryptocurrency, and that they have made it really easy to donate cryptocurrency through their website. And you know, that is a lesson to nonprofits, I think. You know, lots of questions about what role cryptocurrency will play in our society, but you know, GiveDirectly is certainly an organization that has benefited from the rise of cryptocurrency. And then, you know, the CDC Foundation is a really interesting example as well, because I have to hypothesize, at least, that part of the rush of new donors that you just talked about to the CDC Foundation was simply a recognition that their work was important during a pandemic. But I have to bet that some of it was almost anger that the CDC wasn't being listened to by many politicians and many citizens. And it was almost a political statement to make a donation to the CDC Foundation, which again gets to, you know, a dynamic that we've talked about before, which is the way that politics has made its way into the patterns of giving that we see in our society. So in both of those examples, I do think you're right. It may point to longer term trends in the field. And I think, you know, remains to be seen how positive those are together, but there are certainly things in there to be excited about and things to be worried about.
More in a moment with Jacob Harold of Candid on the NPT 100 and where donor-advised funds fit into the equation.
If you like what you're hearing, share it with friends and colleagues on social media. Use the hashtag FreshResearch or retweet the Nonprofit Times link, and you'll be eligible to win a book from the NPT Library. Another way for folks to find the show, rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. For more than 30 years, the Nonprofit Times has been the leading business publication for nonprofit management. To subscribe, visit shopthenonprofittimes.com. You'll also find special issue coverage, relevant research like our salary and benefits report, and best nonprofits to work for, plus other special reports and webinars. And keep up with the latest breaking news and in-depth reporting at thenonprofittimes.com.
Now back to our conversation with Jacob Harold, Executive Vice President of Candid. And you mentioned something earlier about rainy day funds in terms of organizations being able to, even during the Great Recession, had been able to put away some money for a rainy day. And one thing I think we have to note in the 100 is that it doesn't include donor advised funds, simply because they probably, you know, they give to directly to other organizations into the 100. So we try to avoid double counting, but it's still, you have to kind of talk about it because it's a huge part of the sector. You know, these organizations, to give some context, the NPT 100 organizations this year had total assets of $113 billion. And the largest was the YMCA with $11.6 billion in total assets. But that includes, obviously, YMCA has a lot of brick and mortar buildings. To put that in context, the three largest commercial donor advised funds, Fidelity, Vanguard, and Schwab, they reported revenues of combined of $20 billion and total assets of $63 billion. So that's right there, between the three donor advised funds, the three more or less the largest, that's half of the total assets of the entire 100 organizations. And Fidelity alone was more than half of that at $35 billion. In assets. And normally, not normally, but if we were to include donor advised funds, they would have been number one with more than double of the YMCA's revenue at $13 billion. What, and I'm trying to put this as diplomatically as I can. Donor advised funds, everyone seems to refer to them as being that rainy day fund. And now some nonprofits will say, well, it was pouring during pandemic. And donor advised funds did distribute a lot more this year in the last 2 years during the pandemic. But some of those numbers are just kind of astounding in terms of just the sheer size of those commercial DAFs relative to charities. Is that an issue that is going to go away at all in terms of taking over the nonprofit sector or giving? Is that cause for concern about charities? And where do they go from here in terms of getting a piece of that somehow, or not, you know, how do they avoid getting crowded out by such just sheer mammoth size of those donor advised funds?
Yeah. Well, I mean, to your question, it is definitely not a question that is going to go away. There's increasing attention on donor advised funds. All the numbers that you cite are consistent with my understanding as well, and, you know, are not new. This has been true for many years, but, you know, arguably is accelerated. As you note, the amount of giving by donor advised funds went way up over the last couple of years as well. I do think it's important to recognize that even though donor advised funds are, from a legal standpoint, nonprofits, they're really playing a function that's more like a financial institution in the field. And so I think you all were right to not include them in this list. And it's interesting, you know, there are two other categories that you didn't include: hospitals and universities. And I think in both cases, that made total sense. It's a reminder of the diversity of the sector, the complexity of the sector. And I think, you know, donor advised funds, I would argue, have played a quite productive role, and that now is a good time to be having these conversations about how might that need to evolve over time. I'm encouraged to see the amount of giving that came out of them last year, but given the sheer scale of it, I expect it's going to get a lot more attention. And I'll just say broadly, something we've been struggling with at Candid, we struggled with it with the US social sector dashboard that I mentioned, is that a list like the NPT 100 reflects common understanding of what nonprofits are. It's a list of big brand names, Boys and Girls Club and the Red Cross and Feeding America, that average people know, and that meets their sense of what nonprofits are. But we consistently find, when we look at these aggregate numbers, that the sheer scale of donor advised funds, universities, and nonprofit hospitals often can dwarf these brand name institutions. And so how do we figure out how to talk about this list of kind of common language nonprofits or common sense nonprofits? And while still recognizing that institutions like donor advised funds or nonprofit hospitals are legally nonprofits and do belong as part of the social sector, even if a lot of Americans may not think of them as nonprofit organizations.
The other question I would have is, you mentioned brand name organizations, and some of the surveys I see about donors and where they give, particularly young donors, are more likely to go give toward crowdfunding that isn't necessarily to an organization, but directly to people, you know, whether it's friends or family or someone in need, like a GoFundMe, you know, health costs, or maybe some sort of fundraiser for someone who's been in a friend who's been in an accident. Young people are more likely to do that, even if there's no tax deduction involved. Is that something between that and, say, cryptocurrency? Where do you see the next 5-10 years in terms of giving, and what you're seeing now, you know, as millennials get older, and I remember millennials, some people still think of millennials as being in their 20s and, you know, just young whippersnappers, but a lot of millennials now are pushing 40 and starting families and settling down. Some of these other avenues of giving, do you think that might shift some of the giving, at least channels or from organizations to others, or to other just avenues?
I mean, I think unquestionably, you know, and we even see that, I would argue, in the data from, you know, the last year. The question is, how quickly does that happen? How deeply does it change nonprofit business models? And I think those are open questions. So to me, it's not a question of if, it's a question of how much, and a question of when. I expect that the core business models of most nonprofits will be able to last for quite some time, but that there will be organizations like GiveDirectly that bring in totally new approaches, and that changes around the edge will really start to add up, whether that's crowdfunding, impact investing, cryptocurrency, et cetera. So, you know, we're going to see all of those. What I can't predict is, you know, how quickly and how deeply. But, you know, to me, you know, again, I think this last year is encouraging in that it shows the overall resilience of the sector. You know, and I think, you know, I've been encouraged, I would say, by four things. One is the resilience of the sector. The second was the generosity of individual donors stepping up in a time of need. The second one was the flexibility of institutional donors in realizing that they needed to restructure some of their processes. And then also just the programmatic creativity of nonprofits. And so all of those to me would suggest that the social sector can figure out how to evolve, you know, whether it's an external threat like a pandemic or the, you know, potential but question marks of something like crowdfunding or cryptocurrency or impact investing. But, you know, I think it remains to be seen how deeply we're willing to go. Like another takeaway from all of this is that, you know, examples like the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society aside, there wasn't a ton of structural innovation in the nonprofit sector over the last 18 months. There wasn't a huge uptick in M&A or in restructuring affiliate networks or in, you know, reimagining the timeline that an organization would even exist, questions of spend down, et cetera. There was definitely some. I don't want to say that there wasn't any, but there wasn't as much as I thought a world historical event like this pandemic might inspire among nonprofit leaders. And so I think that as we enter into the next few years and we're wrestling with some of these big new trends, I hope that we start to see more of that structural innovation, more willingness to think, oh, you know what, actually, maybe we should go out of business in 10 years, or maybe we need to merge with a nonprofit next door, or maybe we need to split into a nonprofit and a for-profit, or maybe we need to completely pool all of our backend expenses with a dozen partner organizations, you know, or whatever kind of structural innovation is appropriate given all of these changes that we're seeing seeing around us. And these changes are not about to end. If anything, I expect they'll accelerate.
Do you think some of those innovations and maybe structural changes might be happening below the surface, meaning the surface for us right now is the NPT 100 and these giant mega organizations, but maybe smaller charities that are basically innovate or die? I mean, I was surprised how often I would talk to smaller organizations in the last year when the pandemic started, and they would do virtual things for the first time. I was kind of surprised that they would have virtual events, even say arts organizations would be live streaming. And they're like, well, we never tried it before, but we had to. And I was surprised because I was like, well, you never did that before? And it was just surprising, I guess. I would think maybe the larger organizations, I suppose, did that. And I took for granted that other organizations would do it just as easily. But do you think some of that stuff is happening below the surface and it'll bubble up? Or maybe there's a lag that will come with the long tail of COVID, maybe next year, the year after, whether it's mergers or innovations?
So what I would say is, there's been so much programmatic innovation, largely led by nonprofit staff. When you think about a structural question, those are often debates that need to happen at the board level. Mm-hmm. So what is a bit invisible to me right now is what might bubble up from board conversations over the last year and a half. I would definitely say that the kind of programmatic innovation that we've seen from nonprofits is quite encouraging and maybe has shaken some organizations up in really interesting and productive ways. So I'm excited by that and encouraged by it. And what I'm hoping is that these sort of bigger governance questions will also bubble up into structural innovation that might take a little longer. But I really don't know because, you know, we at Candid have a lot of data, but, you know, we don't have secret microphones recording board meetings, you know, across the country. We just have to guess what's happening in those conversations, and we can get an anecdotal sense. But, you know, time will tell whether nonprofit boards have said, you know what, now is a time for us to be more creative about our structure, our duration, our purpose, our organizational strategy. And so we'll see about that.
Great. Jacob, anything else that really struck you about the 100 this year or things that you're going to be keeping an eye on in the future?
I mean, like so much else in our world right now, it is a mixture of being encouraged and being disappointed, but still hopeful. And so I look at these numbers and I see a sector that overall is thriving, but also one that has an opportunity to do some things differently and to take the lessons of the last couple of years as we evolve going forward. So I'm hopeful, but I still think we have a lot of work to do.
Well, Jacob, thanks so much for your time. It's always a great conversation to have with you.
Definitely, Mark. Yeah, thanks so much for having me on.
That's our episode for today. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to share the Fresh Research link on Twitter or Facebook to be eligible to win something from the NPT Library. You can also share on social media with the hashtag #FreshResearch. And if you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. This has been Fresh Research, a podcast from the Nonprofit Times, spotlighting research and trends in the philanthropic sector. Till next time, keep up with us at thenonprofittimes.com for all your nonprofit news.